Tara's request for a formal meeting to discuss their matrimonial arrangements threw Shaza into a state of utmost consternation. He had been well enough satisfied by the informal understanding between them, by which he had complete freedom of action and control of the children, together with the respectability and protection of the marriage form. He had been happy to pay without comment the bills that Tara forwarded to him, and to see that her generous allowance was paid into her bank account promptly on the first of each month. He had even made good the occasional shortfall when the bank manager telephoned him to report that Tara had overdrawn. On one occasion, there was a cheque made out to a second-hand motor dealer for almost £1,000. Shaza did not query it. Whatever it was a bargain as far as he was concerned. Now it looked as if all this was coming to an end, and Shaza immediately called a meeting of his principal advisers in the boardroom of Santine House. Santine herself was in the chair, and Abram Abrams had flown down from Johannesburg, bringing with him the senior partner of a firm of renowned but very expensive divorce lawyers. Santon took over immediately. "Let us consider the worst possible case," she told them crisply. "Tara will want the children, and she'll want a settlement, plus a living allowance for herself and each of the children." She glanced at Abe, who nodded his silver head, which set the rest of the legal counsel nodding like mandarin dolls, looking grave and learned, and secretly counting their fees, Shaza thought wryly. "Damn it! Damn it, the woman deserted me. I'll go to hell before I give her my children. She will claim that you made it impossible for her to remain in the conjugal home," Abe said. And then when he saw Shaza's thunderous expression, tried to soothe him. "You must remember, Shaza, that she'll probably be taking the best available legal advice herself." "Damn shyster lawyers," said Shaza bitterly, and his counsel looked pained. But Shaza did not apologize nor qualify. "I've already warned her I won't give her a divorce. My political career is at a very delicate stage. I cannot afford the scandal. Very soon I'll be contesting a general election." "You may not be able to refuse," Abe murmured. "Not if she has good grounds." "She hasn't any," said Shaza virtuously. "I've always been the considerate and generous husband." "Your generosity is famous," Abe murmured dryly. "There is many an attractive young lady who could give you a testimonial on that score." "Really, Abe," Santan intervened, "Shaza has always kept out of trouble with women." "Santan, my dear, we are dealing with facts here, not maternal illusions. I am not a private detective, and Shaza's private life is none of my concern. However, completely disinterested as I am able to cite you at least six occasions in the last few years when Shaza has given Tara ample grounds." Shaza was making frantic signals down the table to shut Abe up, but Santan leaned forward with an interested expression. "Go ahead, Abe," she ordered. "Start citing. In January 2 years ago, the leading lady in the touring production of the musical Oklahoma," Abe began, and Shaza sank down in his chair and covered his eyes as though in prayer. "A few weeks later, the left winger, ironically, in the visiting British women's hockey team." So far, Abe was avoiding mentioning names. But now he went on. "Then there was the famous TV producer from North American Broadcasting Studios, pert little vixen with a name like a fish. No, a dolphin. That's it. Kitty Godolphin. Do you want me to go on? There are a few more. But as I have said already, I am not a private investigator. You can be sure that Tara will get herself a good one." And Shaza makes very little effort to cover his tracks. "That will do, Abe," Santine stopped him and considered her son with disapproval and a certain grudging admiration. "It's the Dettieri blood," she thought, "the family curse. Poor Shaza." But she said sternly, "It looks as though we do have a problem after all." And she turned to the divorce lawyer. "Let us accept that Tara has grounds of infidelity. What is the worst judgment we might expect against us?" "It's very difficult, Mrs. Courtney. I'm not going to hold you to it," Santan told him brusquely. "You don't have to equivocate. Just give me the worst case." "She could get custody, especially of the two younger children, and a large settlement." "How much?" "Considering your circumstances, it could be..." The lawyer hesitated delicately. £1,000,000, plus the trimmings, a house and allowance, and a few other lesser items." Shaza sat up very straight in his chair. He whistled softly and then murmured, "Oh, that really is taking seriously something that was merely poked in fun," he said. And nobody laughed. So Shaza took pains preparing for the reunion with Tara. He studied the written advice which Abe and the other lawyers had drawn up for him, and had his tactics firmly established. He knew what to say and what to avoid. He was to make no admissions and no promises, particularly regarding the children. For the venue, he chose the pool at the foot of the Constantia Berg, hoping that Tara would associate it with the happy hours they had spent there. He had his chef prepare an exquisite picnic hamper, which contained all Tara's favourite delicacies, and he chose half a dozen bottles of his best wines from the cellar. He took especial care with his appearance. He had his hair trimmed and picked out a new black silk eye patch from the drawer that he kept full of them. He wore the aftershave she had given him and the cream-coloured wild silk suit, which she had once remarked on favourably, with his Air Force scarf in the open neck of his blue shirt. All the children were packed off to Rhodes Hill into Santine's care for the weekend, and he sent the chauffeur in the Rolls to fetch Tara from Molly Broadhurst's home, where she was staying. The chauffeur brought her directly up to the pool, and Shaza opened the door for her and was surprised when she offered him her cheek for his kiss. "You look so well, my dear," he told her. And it was not entirely untrue. She had lost a lot of weight. Her waist was once again wasped in, and her bosom was magnificent. Despite the gravity of the moment, Shaza felt his loins stir as he looked down at that cleavage. "Down, boy," he admonished himself silently, and looked away, concentrating on her face. Her skin had cleared. The rings below her eyes were barely discernible, and her hair had been washed and set. Obviously, she had taken the same pains with her appearance as he had. "Where are the children?" she demanded immediately. "Mater has them, so we could talk without interruption." "How are they, Shaza?" "Oh, they're all just fine. Couldn't be better." He wanted there to be no special pleading on that score. "I do miss them terribly," she said. The remark was ominous, and he did not reply. Instead, he led her to the summer house and settled her on the couch facing the waterfall. "It's so beautiful here," she looked around her. "It is my favourite spot on all of Veldfrieden." She took the wine glass he handed her. "Better days," he gave her the toast. They clinked glasses and drank. Then she set her glass down on the marble tabletop, and Shaza steeled himself to receive the opening shot of the engagement. "I want to come back home," she said, and he spilled white wine down the front of his silk suit, and then dabbed at it with the handkerchief from his breast pocket to give himself time to recover his balance. In a perverse way, he had been looking forward to the bargaining. He was a businessman, supremely confident in his ability to get the best trade. Furthermore, he had already adjusted to the idea of becoming a bachelor once more, and was beginning to look forward to the delights of that state, even if it cost him £1 million. He felt the prickle of disappointment. I don't understand," he said carefully. "I miss the children. I want to be with them. And yet I don't want to take them away from you. They need a father as much as a mother." It was too easy. There had to be more than that. Shaza's bargaining instincts were sure. "I've tried living alone," she went on, "and I don't like it. I want to come back." "So we just pick it up again where we dropped it?" he asked carefully, but she shook her head. "That's impossible. We both know that." She prevented further questions with a raised hand. "Let me tell you what I want. I want to have all the benefits of my old life, access to my children, the prestige that goes with the name Courtney, and the money, not to have to stint." "You were always scornful of the position and the money before." He could not prevent the jibe, but she took no offence. "I had never had to do without it before," she said simply. "However, I want to be able to go away for a while when it becomes too much for me here, but I will not embarrass you politically or in any other way." She paused. "That's all of it." "And what do I get in return?" he asked. "A mother for your children and a public wife. I will preside at your dinner parties and make myself agreeable to your associates. I will even help you with your political electioneering. I used to be very good at that." "I thought that my politics disgusted you." "They do, but I will never let it show." What about my conjugal rights, as they are delicately referred to by the lawyers? No, she shook her head. That will only complicate our relationship. She thought of Moses. She could never be unfaithful to him, even if he had ordered it. No, but I have no objection to you going elsewhere. You have always been reasonably discreet. I know you will continue to be. He looked at her bosom and felt a twinge of regret. But the bargain she was offering amazed him. He had everything he wanted, and had saved himself £1 million into the bargain. Is that all? He asked. Are you sure? Unless you can think of anything else we should discuss? He shook his head. Shall we shake hands on it, and open a bottle of the widow? She smiled at him over the rim of her glass to conceal what she truly felt for him in his world, and she made a vow as she sipped the tingling yellow wine. You will pay, Charles Courtney. You will pay for your bargain, much more than you ever, ever dreamed. For over a decade, Tara had been the mistress of Velta Frieden, so there was nothing difficult or alien in taking up that role again, except that now, more than ever, she felt that she was acting a part in a tedious and unconvincing play. There were some differences, however. The guest list had altered subtly, and now included most of the top nationalist politicians and party organisers, and more often than before, the conversation at the dinner table was in Afrikaans rather than English. Tara's knowledge of Afrikaans was adequate. It was, after all, a very simple language, with a grammar so uncomplicated that the verbs were not even conjugated, and much of the vocabulary was taken directly from English. However, she had some difficulty with the guttural inflections, and most of the time smiled sweetly and remained silent. She found that by doing so, her presence was soon overlooked, and she heard much more than she would have had she joined in the conversation. A frequent visitor to Velta Frieden now was the Minister of Police, Manfred de la Rey, and Tara found it ironical that she was expected to feed and entertain the one man who, to her, epitomised all that was evil and cruel in the oppressive regime that she hated with all her being. It was like sitting down to a meal with a man-eating leopard. Even his eyes were pale and cruel as those of a great predatory cat. Strangely, she found that despite her loathing, the man fascinated her. It surprised her to find, once she had got over the initial shock of his presence, that he had a fine brain. Of course, it was common knowledge that he had been a brilliant student in the law faculty of Stellenbosch University, and before standing for Parliament, he had built up a highly successful law practice in his own right. She knew also that no man who was not essentially brilliant was included in the Nationalist cabinet. Yet his intelligence was sinister and ominous. She found herself listening to the most heinous concepts, expressed with such logic and eloquent conviction that she had to shake herself out of his mesmeric influence like a bird trying to break the spell of the cobra's swaying dance. Manfred de la Rey's relationship to the Courtney family was another enigma to her. It was part of family law how his father had robbed the honey mine of £1 million of diamonds, and how Blaine, her own father, and Santon, before she was Blaine's wife, had pursued him into the desert, and after a fierce battle, captured him. Manfred's father had served 15 years of a life sentence before being released under the amnesty that the Nationalists had granted to so many Afrikaans prisoners when they came to power in 1948. The two families should have been bitter enemies. And indeed, Tara detected definite traces of that hatred in the occasional tone of a remark and unguarded look that Manfred de la Rey and Shaza directed at each other. And there was a peculiarly brittle and artificial quality to the overtly friendly facade they showed, as though at any moment it might be stripped away and they would fly at each other's throats like fighting dogs. On the other hand, Tara knew that Manfred was the one who had enticed Shaza into forsaking the ailing United Party and joining the Nationalists with the promise of ministerial rank, and that Shaza had made the de la Reys, father and son, major shareholders and directors in the new fish canning company at Walvis Bay, a company which looked set to turn £500,000 of profit in its very first year of operation. The mystery of their relationship was made even more intriguing by Santon. On the second occasion that Shaza invited Manfred de la Rey and his wife to dine at Velta Frieden, Santon had telephoned her a few days beforehand and asked her bluntly if she and Blaine might join the party. Although Tara had determined to see as little of Saint-Ange as possible, and to do all in her power to reduce Saint-Ange's influence over the children and the general running of the estate, Tara had been so taken aback by the direct request that she had not been able to think of an excuse. Of course, Mater, she had agreed with false enthusiasm. I would have invited you and Daddy anyway, but I thought you might have found the evening tedious. And I know Daddy cannot abide Delarey. Whatever gave you that idea, Tara? Saint-Ange asked tartly. They are on opposite sides of the house, but Blaine has a healthy respect for Delarey, and he concedes that Delarey certainly handled the troubles firmly enough. His police did a magnificent job in clamping down on the ringleaders and preventing serious disruptions and further loss of life. Furious words filled Tara's mouth, and she wanted to hurl them at her mother-in-law. But she gritted her teeth and took a deep breath before she said sweetly, "Well then, Mater, both Shaza and I will be looking forward to Friday night. 7:30 for 8, and naturally the men will be wearing black tie." "Naturally," said Saint-Ange. It had been a surprisingly mellow evening, when the explosive elements seated around the same table were considered. But it was a strict rule of Shaza's that shop party politics were never discussed in Velta Friedan's palatial dining room. The men's conversation ranged from the projected All Blacks rugby tour to the recent angling capture of a 600-pound bluefin tunny in False Bay, the first of its kind. Manfred Delarey and Blaine were both keen anglers and were excited by the prospect of such a magnificent prize.